Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our media roundtable. And today we are talking about media coverage of the economy, tax cuts, poverty, and austerity. And we're joined by journalists covering these issues in Kansas, the UK, and Brazil. Kansas is making national headlines for its governor's race. In July, 100 Republicans signed a letter supporting the Democratic candidate for governor over Republican Governor Sam Brownback. Republicans for Kansas Values called the cuts a reckless fiscal experiment and said Brownback's administration is hostile to public education. This is getting attention from The Daily Show, Real Time with Bill Maher, and Rolling Stone. And in about 30 minutes, we'll be joined by Tim Carpenter, reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal. And it's been 4 years since harsh austerity measures were implemented in the UK. Journalist Mary O'Hara spent years talking to working people about how they've been affected. She says the wealth gap between the rich and the poor is heading for a new gilded age. Mary O'Hara is a social justice reporter with The Guardian in London and author of the new book Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. And Mary joins me here in studio. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, thanks, Rose.
Great to have you. And in Brazil, Dilma Rousseff was elected to a second term in office. This was a close race. She won with 51.6% of the popular vote. She is being credited with lifting some 40 million people out of poverty by expanding the social safety net for the poor. And joining us to discuss coverage is Mauricio Savarese. He's a freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo. He has contributed to a number of news organizations, including Al Jazeera, NPR, and the New York Times. Hi, Mauricio. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi. It's great to have you. So, as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting good journalism of the week. So, let's start off with you, Mary O'Hara, with The Guardian. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm just going to plug someone I've worked with for a long time, if that's okay. My favorite columnist at The Guardian is Aditya Chakraborty, and he writes wonderfully on austerity and the economics behind it. And he did a story this week that focused in on a couple of local stories, actually, where people had been forced to steal to feed their families. This has been happening more and more in the UK as austerity has kicked in. People who are just reaching desperate straits have nowhere else to turn. And he writes about one woman who stole some food and a bar of soap for her toddler and ended up being fined £2,000 for stealing what was basically a £12 grocery. Some products. And the reason this woman had to steal these things was because her benefits that she relied on had been cut. She hadn't received them, so she had literally nowhere to go. And Aditya also focuses on the rise of food poverty generally and the fact that food banks are proliferating across the UK as more and more people can't feed their families. The number of food banks has swollen beyond recognition in the UK, and something like 500,000 people are turning to them on a weekly basis.
What kind of reaction does a story like this get, specifically a story about people stealing food to feed their families?
Well, this has been something that really was unheard of before. It's something quite new to the UK, really, because the social safety net used to be strong enough for at least to feed people. Mm. And a term that's been used quite a lot is heat or eat. You know, do you heat your home or do you buy your food? And the reaction to these stories it's interesting because it depends on what newspaper you read, what reaction you'll get. So some of the tabloids like the Daily Mirror cover these stories wonderfully, and they really highlight the human fallout of it. The Guardian does the same, The Independent. Now, if you were reading some other newspapers or watching mainstream television, you might not know about these stories at all. So the reaction depends on where you get your news from still.
Well, thank you for that. And we're going to talk to you later in the hour about your book that focuses on these issues. That's Mary O'Hara. She's a social justice writer with The Guardian and author of the new book, Austerity Bites. What about you, Mauricio Savarese? You're a freelance journalist in Sao Paulo. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, we're very much immersed in the elections yet, so we're basically talking about that during the week. And the most interesting articles I've seen are basically addressing how Brazil is complex with social programs and how people that voted for President Dilma Rousseff, not necessarily, although they some of them actually depend on social programs, they did not vote for her, and that is because of plenty of other issues, that regional issues, class issues, and the media, of course. Just to give a brief outlook, the second state of Brazil which gets the most investment of social programs is the São Paulo state, which is the wealthiest in the country and the most populous in the country. And in the election itself, Dilma Rousseff got 35% of the vote, which is not much. She lost by 7 million votes in São Paulo state, although there are many social programs actually working here too. And well, what's complex behind that mindset is to see that even people who depend on social programs or who need them, they believe in the São Paulo state that Brazil has to grow more, and to grow more, perhaps you have to deal with some austerity measures. But if you look at the northeast of the country, which is growing more rapidly than the country itself, Dilma Rousseff got 70% of the vote, and that is about an 11 million votes difference in all the states of that region, comparing to the opposition candidate, Aécio Neves. And that is the region where social programs are very, very important to. But what I read in the story is that Folha de São Paulo, Brazil's most popular newspaper, wrote about it, is that although social programs explain some of the vote, and the need for some austerity measures also explain another chunk of it, Brazil is so mixed up in that sense, and this election was such a cliffhanger that it's difficult to put all the results for Dilma Rousseff and for Aécio Neves, the opposition candidates, basically to credit them to social programs or to austerity measures.
And where are you seeing good coverage of this race and the complexities involved?
Well, to be very, very honest, that's the other issue we're debating, because there's a very, very partisan magazine in Brazil called Veja, and they printed an article last Friday which could have impacted the elections dramatically, such a tight election. It could have impacted dramatically, and they put it on the cover. There's a corruption scheme at Petrobras, and allegedly one of the people who were involved there said that President Dilma Rousseff knew about the corruption scandal. But as the week began and the investigations dug deeper, there was really nothing. So a good chunk of Brazilian media are now debating, should we trust these accusations that come just in the final week of the campaign trail? And that has been the case at least since 2006, with different accusations, of course, and mostly coming from the same source. So we're now debating credibility of the electoral coverage. In the last three times, that must be said, it was very much against the Workers' Party, which is the ruling party in Brazil at the moment. And we're going to do some soul searching until the end of the year, at least, of how do we do with a magazine that was respectable when they have accusations in the final week of the campaign trail.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mauricio Savarese. He's a freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo, and we will put links to the stories mentioned at yourcallradio.org. And Mauricio, I had no idea that voting is mandatory in Brazil. We often talk about Australia, but we don't talk about Brazil. And I understand that more than 140 million people are registered to vote in Brazil. It's mandatory. So are people fined if they don't vote in Brazil? How does that work?
Well, it is actually less intimidating than it looks, because 20% of the vote in the runoff and in the first round, too, it was basically abstention. It was either people not showing up or people just giving a blank vote, as we say, to any of the candidates. So, and if you don't show up and you don't come up to one of the polling stations to say, well, I'm far away from home, so I can't vote, you pay a R$3 fine, which is like $1. So it is mandatory, and it is something that was introduced after Brazil was redemocratized in 1985. But it was meant to get people to go to the polling stations, to understand that voting was important, but it doesn't play this massive role of all voters that are registered actually go to the polls. It's not a fact for the last five elections, at least, that and the average of abstention is 20%, really.
Hmm. And also Reuters reports that voting is electronic, even at remote Amazon polling stations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. So you can get the results very, very quickly. The one reason we didn't get the results just 2 hours after the voting was ended is because we have time difference in some regions of Brazil, so we had to wait until the last voter cast their vote, so then we could Brazil could publish the first result. So basically at the same time that the last vote was cast, we had 95% of the vote already counted, and it already signaled that the President Dilma Rousseff was going to be reelected, because we knew that the 5% of votes that was still to be counted, it came from the regions which are Dilma Rousseff's stronghold. So at 8 p.m. Brazil time, the polls were closed at 5, but at 8 p.m. we already knew the results, so it was very smooth, to be very honest.
Can you talk a little bit about the social turmoil and how that affected the campaign? Because we've seen so many mass protests in Brazil over the years over price hikes, corruption. There were daily protests during the World Cup. How did that affect this election?
It is very interesting to see that the social movements are still impacted by that, but the elections themselves, they are more impacted by the people who were at home watching. And the people who were at home watching, they are mostly conservative. They are either social conservatives or conservative conservatives. So you can look at Brazil's Congress at the moment, which was elected 3 weeks ago, and it is much more conservative than it used to be. So you have more evangelical leaders that are very, very conservative going in. You have military forces. You have policemen, people that are for reducing minor age to 16, which is a major issue in Brazil at the moment. And you can see that some of the key leaders that were challenged during the protests last year, they were reelected. So President Dilma Rousseff was reelected. The governor of São Paulo State, Geraldo Alckmin, was also reelected. The governor of Rio is a man named Luiz Fernando Pezão, who is the successor of the governor, which was heavily criticized in the protests there. So you can see that the protests, they didn't have such a big impact in the elections themselves. You didn't have the voters that were protesting, choosing a candidate to go for and a platform to fight for. But you can see that the people that were at home watching, they were also showing that they were upset with the way the protests were taken over the last year or so. Some of them were actually resentful for the fact that police were being challenged by black bloc protesters. Mm-hmm. So since they saw the protesters as hooligans or people that could be very difficult, they chose to go for the people who are for the police and for the way the police acts in Brazil. So, but it's not over. I repeat that because although the elections are an important mirror for the country to see itself, the protests are going to have long lasting impacts, and that's going to come maybe in the next election that is coming in the next maybe in the Olympics in Rio. You're going to see something that is more broad-based and protesters actually convincing more people that Brazil needs structural reform. But in this election, we didn't see it.
Also, Dilma Rousseff is credited with lifting 40 million people out of poverty by expanding the social safety net for the poor. This is being reported widely. Can you talk about that?
Of course. Well, since 2003, not only President Dilma Rousseff, but President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, They used a number of programs that existed already under President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, which was president from 1994 to 2002. So they brought all these programs together and they created a program called Bolsa Família. And they, of course, injected loads more of money in that, so they get credit for that too. Bolsa Família is a program that it's basically helping people with amounts that are not really gigantic. It's about $100 for each kid. And there is a limit to that. So when you see that kind of money going into small communities, consumption is also stimulated. So you can see that the families live better, and you can see that the businesses in those regions also live better. And there is a full economy growing, especially in small cities and medium-sized cities, exactly those where Dilma Rousseff has won the elections by large, which is incentivated by both the family and by the minimum wage policies as well. So the dragging 40 million out of poverty since 2003 has two main reasons, of course. One of them is the social program, Bolsa Família, which has helped loads of people, and also the minimum wage policy, which has impacted for people who were not in dramatic situation, that were poor, and now they're in this aspiring middle class, as they say, because they're not this educated European or American middle class that goes to college and buys books and wants to travel so much, but they are now having access to buy new TV sets, they can buy new computers, so they're entering Brazil's markets in a way. And those 40 million, they come basically out of those two.
That is Mauricio Savarese. He's a freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo, and we're talking about the election in Brazil. We are also joined today by Mary O'Hara. She is a social justice reporter with The Guardian in London and author of the new book, Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about what's happening in Brazil, if you have any questions for Mauricio, he'll be with us for a few more minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment online at yourcallradio.org. Mary, I know that you're on book tour. You haven't been following the election closely in Brazil.
Yeah.
But what's so fascinating is when you talk about austerity and budget cuts and poverty, so many of the same stories are happening around the globe. What really strikes you about what you're hearing from Mauricio?
Well, I think what really strikes me is the contrast with what's happening in the UK. So here you have Brazil taking 40 million people out of poverty. And in Britain, we are putting people into poverty. Now, a lot of research has been done on this since the austerity policies came into place. Organisations like the IFS, lots of, you know, research organisations like the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, looking very closely at who's being pushed into poverty and why. There are more lone parents being pushed into poverty, more children being pushed into poverty as their parents struggle to earn wages to cover their bills. And it was the case under the previous government that there was an aim to reduce child poverty dramatically by 2020, and that's actually gone into reverse as a result of austerity policies. And that includes a number of things. It includes things like cuts to benefits that existed to help low-income families or families that where no one was working. But it also is as a result of cuts to services as well that those families rely on. So parents who can no longer work the hours they want to work because the childcare facilities aren't available in their communities anymore. So we have a lot of people being thrown into dire straits who were doing okay before as a direct result of these policies.
We have an email from Pauline who says, when I left the UK 20 years ago, food banks were unheard of, regarded as an invention of the United States. How sad that the country of social welfare and a national health service that my parents fought for after the devastation of World War II has changed so much.
I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the extraordinary things that's happened as these food banks have proliferated is that even government ministers have come out and said, we don't believe that people are going to food banks because they need food. They're going because they're bad at managing their finances, or they're drug addicts, or they're alcoholics, even though the organisations that run the food banks, including church organisations, have so much evidence that says, no, people are turning to us because benefits on which they relied are no longer there. Not because they're feckless, not because they're lazy, or not because they can't manage their own household finances. If someone doesn't have any household finances to manage, then how are they supposed to screw that up?
You have an interesting quote here in your book, because when we put the show together about Brazil and the UK, we thought maybe there's a connection here, and we found one in your book. Can you give us a little context first? You write about what happened in September 2013 when UN Special Housing Investigator Raquel Rolnick visited the UK and said that the, quote, shocking bedroom tax should be axed.
Well, the bedroom tax, without going into too much detail, has been a real flashpoint in terms of austerity policies in the UK. This was a policy that meant that if you were a person or a family living in social housing and were deemed to be over-occupying, i.e. you had a room that didn't currently have someone sleeping in it, then you'd have to either move out of that house or pay extra money every month. Now, the government called it a spare room subsidy. It was quickly labelled as a bedroom tax. Now, effectively, the people that this hit were among the poorest in society already, were disabled people, who a lot of people who had adjusted their homes for their disability were being told, get out of the house if you're over-occupying it. Now, it was also the spur behind a lot of the street protests that happened around austerity. It really got to people. You know, if you can't live in the home that you are paying your rent on anyway to live in, then what, you know, seriously, what else are you going to attack? Now, there's been lots of critics of the policy domestically and internationally. And when the UN rapporteur came over, she did a tour of the country, interviewed people directly affected by it, the way I did. I spoke to a lot of people directly affected by it and realised the trauma that it was causing people, the stress that it was causing them. And a key thing about this is there were no houses for these people to go to. If you lived in a three-bedroom house and the government is telling you to move to a two-bedroom and the government isn't building any two-bedroom homes, well, what are you supposed to do? Guess what? You have to pay the money because you've nowhere to go. You pay the money, you get further into debt, and then you end up at a food bank. So the whole thing is completely related. Now, when she made her statements, the tabloids went ballistic. They just, I mean, she was accused of dabbling in witchcraft. You wouldn't believe the stuff that they threw at her. And government ministers came out and said, who does she think she is coming and telling us that, you know, our policies are bad? Well, actually, she saw it for what it was. She talked to people affected and she communicated that. That was all. It drummed up a level of hysteria that I don't think had been seen before. But it really spoke to the impact that policy was having.
You write that one Tory MP called her a, quote, loopy Brazilian lefty on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in a way, there are similarities with the US here. I mean, if you call someone a liberal, apparently, you know, they're just going to take your taxes and give them to everybody who doesn't do anything. That culture exists to a large extent in Britain and has been accelerated under austerity. So any excuse to call someone a loopy lefty and they'll take it.
Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program, especially the program on Friday. I like the overview of things. My question is has to do with Brazil and the elections. I gather that it's all electronic and that it's a very good system comparable to the system in Venezuela. I'd like to hear your guest comment on that. And in addition, I'd like to hear what he has to say about Congress or Parliament, that really it's based on a proportional system, somewhat quirky, and that it's much less favorable today than the previous Congress was to Rousseff. So I'd like to hear these comments. Thank you very much. I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Max. Mauricio, do you want to take the second one first? And we have just about a minute before we have to let you go.
No problemo. So what I can say is that Congress now in Brazil is very pulverized. You have loads of parties. We have so many parties in Brazilian Congress that they invented a G10 just for you to picture how bizarre this could be. So President Rousseff is aware of that, and that's why she's suggesting that Brazil makes a political reform either via referendum or by some other means that has somehow to bypass Congress. So, of course, that's going to create a lot of stir with Congress. It's going to be difficult for especially the key allies of Brazilian governance, which is a party called PMDB, PMDB. They're very centrist and very corrupted, as many of the accusations in the last decade or so show. So it's going to be tricky for her. Either she's going to bypass Congress and make the political reforms she needs for Brazil to be less corrupted, or she's going to deal with the same kind of politics that have been dealt with in Brazil in the last decade or so. So it's going to be tricky. It's going to be a difficult choice for her.
And Mauricio, can you stick out with us for a few more minutes? Because I have to go to break, but I would love to get you to answer the question about electronic voting.
It will be a pleasure.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mauricio Savarize is a freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo. We're also joined by Mary O'Hara, a social justice writer with The Guardian, author of Austerity Bites. And she'll be speaking at Kepler's in Menlo Park, 1010 El Camino Real, Monday at 7:30. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. We'd love to have you join us. We're talking about media coverage of austerity, budget cuts, and economic policies. It's Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's our final presentation in that time slot for State of the Reunion. Next week, we'll have your say returns at 11 a.m. Today, Al Letson and his team will be having stories from the road, including a story about a road trip that completely shifted Al's life. State of the Reunion coming up in a half an hour here on KALW. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Jeff Chang, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. It looks at how conceptions of race have changed over time through the lens of comic strips, art, protests, and corporate marketing campaigns. How has the way Americans see race changed over the last 50 years? On Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about Party People. It's a new play at Berkeley Rep that focuses on the Black Panthers and intergenerational conversations between activists. So if you get a chance, be sure to see the play. And then on the day after the election, we'll do a post-election show and talk about the important results. Don't forget to vote on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, if you're confused about any of the propositions, we had debates about almost all of them, and you can find archives at yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are talking with journalists about coverage of the economy, tax cuts, austerity, and poverty. We're joined by Mary O'Hara. She's author of the new book, Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. She'll be speaking at Kepler's in Menlo Park. It's 1010 El Camino Real, 7:30 p.m. on Monday. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Mauricio Savarize, freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo. He's been covering the vote in Brazil. And earlier in the show, in case you missed it, we mentioned that 140 million people are registered to vote, where casting a ballot is mandatory. Although, as Mauricio said, it's not like a scary thing. A lot of people actually don't vote, but a lot of people do. And then also, what's fascinating is voting is electronic, even at remote Amazon polling stations. Mauricio, we've had a lot of problems with our electronic voting. We've even had them this time around, but it's not getting that much attention. Have you had any problems with your machines? Do you have a specific corporation running the machines? How does that work?
Well, they have a specific corporation running that, but the major issue with electronic voting is that voters have to know the number of their candidate. And many times, people that are not so techy, they might have difficulties with that. I can mention one incident that shows how complex that is. In the last debate of the presidential elections, candidate Marina Silva was an opposition candidate. She has shifted parties many times, and she had a good intention of vote. But most people didn't know her number. So she showed up at the debate with a number 40 on her chest, basically to show that was those were the numbers people had to press in the electronic voting.
Wow.
So it is different from the Venezuelan model, which is touchscreen. So in Brazil, you have to know the number of your candidate, and that, of course, has an impact. If your candidate is not that popular or has just shifted parties, people might have a difficulty voting for them. They might go to, before they vote, they could actually make a consultation just at the entrance of the polling station to see the numbers, but most people just don't do that. So when they get in front of the electronic device, they just press any number, and they hope for the best.
Wow! Do you have any problems of touchscreen flips? Because here in the U.S., there's a great website, bradblog.com, and he follows what happens with voting screens. And I'm looking at two headlines right now. Touchscreens flip no to yes on Tennessee abortion measure. And then iVotronic touchscreen votes reportedly flipping in Pulaski County, Arkansas. Does this ever happen in Brazil?
No, not really, because we have to press numbers. So there's a proper button for each number. So you have to press the numbers. You don't have a touch screen for that. And it's basically you press the numbers, and then you get to see the picture of the candidate. And if that is the candidate you want, you just press confirm. And then it goes through. If you can correct the numbers too, or you can vote for no one, as many people did. Abstention also counts people that just press the button no one.
So interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mauricio.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. That is Mauricio Savarize. He's a freelance journalist based in Sao Paulo. Mary, what about the UK? Is there electronic voting there?
I'm not aware if they're bringing it in. I mean, at the moment I do mine by postal vote, so that they're barely getting that off the ground.
Huh. Well, that is Mary O'Hara. She's a social justice reporter with The Guardian and author of the new book, Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. And now I would like to welcome Tim Carpenter to the show. Tim is a reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal, and one of his latest pieces focuses on Kansans living in poverty. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Greetings from Kansas.
It's great to have you. Well, since we were talking about voting, what's it like in Kansas? Do you have many electronic voting machines?
I believe there is electronic voting, but when I go to my local polling station, I circle in the black oval like I was taking a standardized exam and shoot it into a machine that looks like a copy machine, and it is tabulated that way.
Hmm. Well, Tim, I'm really glad you're joining us. In fact, you and Mary have been covering very similar things here. We're talking about budget cuts and poverty. And what's fascinating, and I know you've watched these videos, Mary, Kansas is getting national headlines, and I'm sure you've seen the segments, Tim, on The Daily Show, Real Time with Bill Maher. Rolling Stone is covering what's happening in Kansas because 100 Republicans signed a letter supporting the Democrat running for governor over Governor Sam Brownback, and Republicans for Kansas Values are calling Brownback's cuts a reckless fiscal experiment, saying the administration is hostile to public education. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening here, because you cover state politics?
Right. So let's give people a quick primer on the Kansas gubernatorial race. We have a Republican incumbent, Sam Brownback. He aggressively cut taxes and consequently reduce state revenue considerably, and perhaps more so than he ever dreamed. In the last fiscal year, the state was received $340 million less in tax revenue than they anticipated, and they're down again this year. His primary opponent is a Democrat, Paul Davis, who's a member of the state legislature, and his main attack point is the tax policy was excessive. It's jeopardizing funding for public education, transportation, higher education, services for the elderly, and has called for a income tax freeze. The governor pushes back on that and cites his belief in the supply-side economic theory that if you cut taxes, business will boom, the state revenue will grow, and everyone will benefit. And when he originally signed the legislation a couple of years ago, he called it an adrenaline shot to the heart of the economy. In this campaign, when the evidence is really not there of that stupendous growth, he's referred to it more as a kind of a detailed surgical procedure that takes more time than expected.
And so a lot of people are seeing the direct results of this on the ground, and that's what these segments highlighted. Can you talk about that?
You say on the ground, you're referring to...
Like business owners were interviewed by The Daily Show saying, yes, we got a tax cut, but we're not hiring new people. We're just buying new iPads, for example.
Yes, very good. One element of the tax cut, in addition to reducing the individual income tax rates, he wiped out for 190,000 businesses the income tax for the owners of those businesses. And it was put forward as a great measure to help small business. But if you're in a law firm, and this applies to law firms, doctor's office, farmers, if you have an LLC and maybe you're paying, well, just hypothetically, $10,000 a year in income tax on your LLC, well, that's now zero. But $10,000 is not enough to hire another nurse. It's not you can't expand your farming operation. So in terms of creating jobs, there's questions about what kind of effect it really had. Or was it just a great big tax cut for rich people?
Hmm. What stood out for you, Mary, when you watched those two videos, especially looking at the United States from the perspective of someone in the UK?
Well, it's interesting what was just said, actually, in terms of the post-analysis of what's happened, because this is very much similar to what's used in the UK as a way of justifying austerity cuts. There's a sort of classic scenario that if you've introduce these policies and they don't seem to be working, well, actually, that means you haven't done enough of them. And if you introduce them and they seem to be working, even though that's not what's causing them the changes, then you say, yes, we've been successful. And it's interesting to see that post-justification. But what's really interesting to me is the fundamental assumption that businesses will automatically hire if you cut taxes. And actually, often what happens in communities when this sort of thing happens is you take demand out of the system. People aren't able to buy things, if teachers can't be paid, so they lose their jobs, well, they're not spending in the local economy. So actually the businesses that would rely on them to generate demand that would then produce jobs, that dynamic doesn't exist. And like a lot of, I was very interested in business people talking about needing the local public sector workers to spend their money,
right?
Because that helps their businesses. You take their custom away, you actually harm the business.
But how do you see this playing out in terms of how it gets covered? Because a lot of reporters tend to say the jury is still out. You could have one person saying it's not working and another person saying it is working, we just need more time, as you just said.
Yeah, you'll often get contradictory views on this. And I think one of the things that's always worth looking at is the history of these sorts of policies. You know, these sorts of policies aren't anything new. They've happened throughout history. There's a wonderful book by a professor at Brown, Mark Blythe, called The History of a Dangerous Idea, when talking about austerity. And he tracks over 100 years what happens every time these kinds of policies are introduced. And they always harm. They just always harm, and they always harm the most vulnerable people. They harm ordinary working people. And when you siphon taxes off through to the very wealthy, well, that doesn't necessarily go straight back into the economy. People further down the social scale put money back into the economy much more quickly.
You recently moved back to California.
Yeah.
What are your impressions about how poverty and inequality is covered here in the US?
Well, it's interesting because I seek it out, so I'm probably actually the wrong person to ask.
No, but you're the best person to ask because you seek it out.
Because I seek it out. Well, I find that it's not dissimilar to Britain in the sense that there is a sort of almost accepted narrative around this. The idea that if you're poor, it must be your own fault, that there's a flaw with you, not the system. There's not enough coverage of the structural conditions that bring poverty about, or the things that keep people in poverty, like high housing costs, low wages. So I noticed that there's coverage of, say, the protests about increasing minimum wages in various cities. I think that's very encouraging because it's letting people know that this is an issue and it's worth covering. But I think, like the UK, there is a kind of assumption built in that people who are poor because it's their own fault.
We hear that all the time here. And that is Mary O'Hara, social justice reporter with The Guardian and author of the new book, Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. She'll be speaking at Kepler's in Menlo Park Monday night at 7:30. It's 1010 El Camino Real. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Tim Carpenter, reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal. He covers state politics there. And if you'd like to join us, this issue is getting a lot of attention, inequality, budget cuts, economies. If you've seen any of these segments, what are your thoughts on the specific segments on Kansas? And what really strikes you about coverage of how the economy is affecting the election? Are you finding stories where people are actually talking about their personal experiences? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about a piece that you've seen recently, we'd love to hear about it. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment online, yourcallradio.org. Now, Tim, you wrote a great piece, Brownback Follows Spiking Poverty with New Roadmap, to really give a voice to people who have been affected by some of these policies. And you focus on a church in Topeka. You say that the clientele of the church, they give out sandwiches, chips, and cookie, includes the homeless, unemployed, and mentally ill. It increasingly features people with full-time jobs, as well as parents unable to feed their families. You also report that 14% of the state's population is in poverty. 385,000 Kansans live below the poverty rate of $23,000. 80,000 joined the rolls over the last 5 years alone. What really struck you about the people that you met when you wrote this piece?
Well, some of them are hardworking people who are in jobs that just simply don't pay a livable wage. And when you encounter people like this, maybe working for minimum wage, the standard minimum wage, and then you run into politicians, millionaires no less, who don't want to allow somebody to the minimum wage to increase, it can be a bit heartbreaking. Governor Brownback, who's running for re-election here, he created a roadmap when he ran 4 years ago, and one of his issues that was on that short five-point roadmap was reducing the percentage of Kansas children living in poverty. And he really hasn't made a dent in that. He's admitted as such. There's some conflicting information from the U.S. Census Bureau, but really the percentage of children in Kansas living in poverty has been sustained. And one of the ironies of his roadmap policy was that a couple of years into his term, a temporary 1 cent increase in the statewide sales tax was due to expire. And we know the sales tax is regressive. Yet he, because of his huge income tax cuts, he desperately needed state revenue. So he actually argued for making permanent that sales tax, that 1 cent increase, which brings in, we'll say, $350 million a year. And there was some blowback from his Republican peers in the legislature. In the end, they compromised on a slightly decreased figure, but still more than what it would have fallen to had the governor not intervened. So the governor is an advocate for reducing child poverty. He volunteers time at a food bank here in Topeka, but yet some of his policies and some of his approach to governing the state seem to contradict that.
Mary? That's really interesting, because there are parallels with Britain in terms of our sales tax of VAT, which was increased from 17.5% to 20%, and as you say, is a very regressive tax. That happened, and then the top tier tax rate for the wealthy was reduced, and that meant that people who were better off were even more better off, whilst those at the bottom, including children and families with low wages, were much worse off. And it seems to be a pattern that repeats itself over and over again.
Tim reports in his piece that 1 in 5 children in Kansas are in poverty's grasp. This is not just Kansas. I mean, the poverty rates across this country are on the rise, especially for kids. You just tweeted about a really interesting story. I should say you also traveled across the UK to talk to families. There's a great piece, I think it's in The Guardian, and they interview children about what it's like to be poor.
Yeah.
And it's just heartbreaking.
I mean, that was a really great piece, because, and it really, really touched me, because it reminded me of a lot of the interviews that I had done, which is, how does a child feel when they have to go into school hungry? How do they feel when their friends know that their school uniform is too small or too tight or shabby because their parents can't make, you know, the stigma that that brings on children is immense. And I think one of the things that's often missed in discussions around poverty is not just about money. There are a lot of complex factors in there, and that includes feeling like you're a second class citizen and feeling dismissed by other people in society. And children feel that. They really feel it. In this country, something like 40% of children that are born into poverty will stay in poverty. We should be helping those children have some dreams and get out of it, you know. And that, I think, is the saddest thing of all.
Tim, when you interviewed these people, did they talk about the election? Are they making the connections here? Are they planning to vote? Do they feel like they're being heard?
Well, I would say that the turnout among individuals who live in poverty, who work two jobs to get by, sometimes the distance between themselves and the lives, their daily life is quite a bit away from the high level debate about political policy and elections. And in fact, in this gubernatorial race in Kansas, poverty has not been a significant issue. The Democratic challenger has talked about taxes and public schools and the like. The governor himself, who has trailed in the polls for a considerable time to the Democrat, has really run and embraced a series of attack ads that point to the fact that the Democratic candidate was found in a topless club 16 years ago, that some strange ad in which they try to link the Democrat to a murder in another city and appellate court decisions. So they're attack ads, and they're really far afield from some of the principles that the governor laid out when he was elected 4 years ago.
Well, you know, and I have to say, I mean, Bill Maher covered the race because the Democrat is now apologizing. Paul Davis, he went to a strip club at 26. And they're actually using this in ads, Tim? I mean, is this resonating with the voters?
You know, they are using them in TV ads and mailers, and the postcard type mailers that everyone receives around the country at election time. I just got one today from the Republican Party that pointed to the topless club event. One the other day was sent out by a third party, a group, I believe, that had a photograph of a small child, 4 or 5, against a chain link fence. And if you look through the fence, you saw a neon sign that said topless and said Paul Davis sees nothing wrong with this image.
Wow.
So this is the kind of attack ads that they're running in a pretty desperate appeal to retain the governorship.
But is there any way that people see it for the desperation that it is, or are they just not able to sort of access the complex arguments behind it and believe that there must be something other than this going on? It must be the tip of the iceberg?
I think attack ads actually work to a certain degree,
yeah.
But it's a thin line, because it's a thin line that you could easily cross by going too far in an attack ad. And once you've thrown that advertising piece out there and conclude that you made a mistake, it's too late. It's out there. Yeah. And so you can really turn people off. I know personally people who have seen ads about Paul Davis, a Democratic candidate, being at a strip club, telling me that, tell the governor when you see him next, he just lost 4 votes from my family.
Right.
So it can cut both ways. But when you're behind, I believe people turn to these very negative approaches to try to gin up their support.
And in the meantime, you're having to write stories about people queuing for sandwiches.
Yeah, well, I think the real people sometimes in these campaigns get lost.
Yeah.
And also, Tim, it's very significant that Brownback is behind Paul Davis, right? I mean, who knows what's going to happen? We'll let you know on Wednesday for sure. But
let's just call it extraordinary.
Yeah, this is a big deal.
When he was elected 4 years ago, he won, I think, 65% of the vote, if I'm not mistaken. And so the idea that he wouldn't coast, and it was 63% of the vote, and he coasted to victory 4 years ago. He had been in the United States Senate, in the United States House. He was a household name. To think that 4 years later that he would be fighting for his political life was laughable. Even a year ago, laughable. But once some of the economic reality took root, people were concerned about jobs. People are very concerned about the future of their public schools for their kids. Then Davis began polling pretty well. And I'd say out of the last 25 polls that had done on the governor's race, Davis is ahead in 20 of them. So if you aggregate the most recent polls, Davis is up by 4 percentage points.
Wow, this is going to be a fascinating one to watch. We have an email from Carol who says NPR's Morning Edition did a piece back in 2011 and Washington Republicans could not provide a single business person to defend their mantra that raising taxes kills jobs. Mary, what is it like in the UK in terms of just fact-checking these claims?
Oh, well, I think
in the UK media,
it's much the same as it is here. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll have organisations and individuals who spend a lot of time fighting against the statistics that come out. There are bloggers I know in Britain who spend all their time dissecting government statistics that have been manipulated. One of the things that's happening quite a lot in the UK is a government minister will come out and say, oh, unemployment has gone down by X, then the official statistics, i.e. the data that they've been using to make their claim, come out, and it turns out that they've taken one bit of the data and twisted it to paint a picture of an economy in the kind of recovery that it isn't actually in. So it happens a lot.
You also said that, and this isn't very surprising, but when you look at reporting on these issues like inequality and poverty, you get a very different picture depending on what paper you read. Mm-hmm. What is it like for you as a reporter who specifically focuses on these social issues?
Well, actually, it's quite distressing sometimes to see some of the reports that make it into the public domain. A lot of them are vilifying people who are poor, and painting people who need some assistance, even temporary assistance, as scroungers, as skivers, as leeches of some kind. And a thing that really bothers me is it creates real divisions in society. It stops people who maybe haven't experienced poverty from having sympathy or empathy for people who find themselves in that situation. And that hardens attitudes. Now, hardening attitudes affects policymakers. Policymakers respond to those hard attitudes. It has a real impact on people's everyday life.
And do you think, Tim, the national attention that Kansas is receiving is affecting the local coverage? Because I'm noticing, and this is the poverty issue and the social issues are definitely missing from, you know, The Daily Show and Bill Maher. They like to focus on the strip club aspect of it, obviously. But it is interesting to kind of look at that and then to find a local reporter like yourself really focusing on the real issues, education, poverty, for example.
Well, we try to focus on the issues. You know, the outside national attention is interesting. And it's twofold. It's the governor's race. And then we also have a very competitive United States Senate race in which the long-term incumbent, three-term incumbent, is on the ropes against an independent candidate who's running basically against Washington and gridlock. And so with both of those in play, then that's when you get the Wall Street Journal writers. That's where you get the international reporters who will parachute into Kansas, Rolling Stone and so forth, and the TV entertainment guys who are trying to make, sometimes they just make fun of Kansas. So that's,
I know, right?
You know, so,
it's easy to
so
do
we're,
that.
We're, sometimes we're an easy target. But you asked about fact-checking, and for due to the fact that there was some fact-stretching going on in this particularly political race, I started a fact-check column. And because individuals were taking a single fact and then spinning it into a broader narrative that wasn't factual. And so to draw that spin back to the facts takes a lot of time, and it's difficult, but I think it's worthwhile to put that into the paper and try to clarify what people are saying, because of the distortions are happening on both sides, and you take a complex problem and try to boil it down. One of the things that I've become increasingly uncomfortable with, and it's happened in the past, I've been a reporter for 25 years, it's happened in the past, but is when you write a story and try to be nuanced, that the campaigns will take three or four words out of your story and put it in quotations and then declare it something that it is not. And so you'll see things that I've written show up on my doorstep in mailers that don't reflect the story that I wrote. So it's you know, you just want to go bury your head in the sand in the backyard.
It's so interesting because you get that with social media as well.
Right.
Everything has to be distilled.
Right. Well, we will be watching Kansas on Tuesday. Tim Carpenter is a reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal. Be sure to read his really good piece about poverty in Kansas. You'll find it at yourcallradio.org. And be sure to check out Mary O'Hara's work and her new book, Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. She'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park, 1010 El Camino Real, Monday night at 7:30. Tim and Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How have Americans' perceptions of race changed over the last 50 years? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Jeff Chang about his new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. He looks at how conceptions of race have changed through a lens of comic strips, contemporary art, campus protests, and corporate marketing campaigns. After eras framed by words like multicultural and post-racial, how do we see each other today? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.